Good morning. Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, Alan.
How are you?
He was worried. He said, Alan's got golf. He'll be playing golf.
The sun is out. It's cool and crisp, and I have to work this morning. I have to give a presentation in an hour. So.
Well, yesterday, or was it yesterday or Sunday, you got abbreviated. A storm rolled in here. I've never seen anything like it.
Steve, I've been coming here for 35 years. Well, the first time I brought my wife, it snowed, and she said it snows in the desert. But I have never seen thunderstorms in December. And we were on the 15th tee box, and we heard a lot of rumbling. And one of my partners said, you know, you don't see lightning out here, so we better get the hell out. And we headed right to it. It was pouring. And a good round was had and lost.
And you said you were tracking.
I was playing pretty good.
Atta boy. Well, and you mentioned 35 years, and in 35 years of symposiums and industry initiatives and discussions, can you recall a period where there was so much focus on a fairly narrow set of topics?
Actually, following the almost eerily similar situation in New York in 2011, 2012, with the 21 fatalities at Aqueduct, the answer is yes. At that time, it was an existential moment. And I think the symposium after Eight Bells died on the racetrack at the Kentucky Derby, there was some focus on safety, but nothing like today, because we're obviously at one of these other existential moments. And it's a very difficult and somewhat dangerous time for the industry. So I appreciate the fact that the powers that be at the university here at the symposium decided to spend a day on focusing on safety and welfare initiatives.
You've been focused in the Mid-Atlantic and with the THA member bodies on a going basis. You were ahead of the curve on this topic, and in part it dates back to 2012 and the New York Task Force.
Absolutely.
We had Dr. Durenberger earlier this morning, and I referenced 2012 with her, and how many of the same topics are being revisited in some cases or are being introduced more widely in terms of best practices, as the convenient term calls them.
So the circumstances at Aqueduct were eerily similar to what happened at Santa Anita, including the same time of year, unusual weather phenomenon, and you can go down the list. Those of us, it was Scott Palmer, Jerry Bailey, Mary Scalia, and myself, who were asked by the governor to investigate, and there wasn't the knee-jerk reaction, there wasn't the pandering to the horsemen's, to the animal rights groups. We didn't make political statements. We just tried to study and learn as much as we could, and we made 38 recommendations. We made 38 recommendations that were implemented immediately in New York. And if New York had done it on its own, it would have been naked, and New York racing would have been in trouble because of the reforms. They weren't radical, but they so changed racing in New York. And to its credit, the Mid-Atlantic region realized that New York could not be naked because we all work cooperatively in the marketplace. And so the region embraced those reforms. And that was the beginning of a number of things. The National Uniform Medication Program was actually the Mid-Atlantic Uniform Medication and Drug Testing Program that now all of the Mid-Atlantic jurisdictions are compliant. we were in the forefront of eliminating steroids in racing. And that led to reform work we were doing on the safety and welfare of the horse. And at some point we realized we've got to pull this all together. We have to have a cohesive plan. You can't just have a bunch of reforms that are out there. And so working both regionally and nationally, we put together a strategic plan to reduce equine fatalities. And I'm going to talk about it this morning at the symposium. That's my presentation. But the one takeaway is for the group is that since we started implementing these reforms, fatalities in the Mid-Atlantic over the past 5, 6, 7 years have been reduced by 35%. Now, so there's a way to do it.
I had talked earlier when we were talking to Dr. Durenberger about some things, that the Mid-Atlantic region has seemed to have been able to do a lot of things together. I mentioned the match. If you can get people to get together for races, you can get together to do other things. Do you think the fact that California is so far removed from, I mean, they're their own region.
Yes.
Where you're talking here, as you're a Maryland guy, but now you were talking about the problem in New York. Like, New York had someone to lean on close. You had some racing jurisdictions close to, you got to work with each other. Whereas California, we're so far out there that they didn't have anybody locally or even regionally to talk to get together with. They were kind of left on their own. And I'm not using that as an excuse for the way that situation was handled, but I'm not a lot of people maybe came to their aid because of geographically where you guys were able to work together as a region to handle that aqueduct situation.
Well, I don't think that, and look, I don't want to criticize California. They were in very difficult circumstances. They were doing the best they could, and they were reacting as quickly as they could because there were so many forces bearing down on them. But they did not, at least to my knowledge, reach out beyond their own state to solve this problem. And you know, California is somewhat on an island. I mean, you're talking Santa Anita, Del Mar, Los Alamitos, and then you've got Golden Gates North. But, you know, you've got a small, finite horse population. That's not the Mid-Atlantic. The Mid-Atlantic is seven states. You can have 13 racetracks operating at the same time. You have horsemen moving from state to state. So if you want to talk about uniformity, if you want to talk about cooperation, if you want to talk about best practices, you've got to do it in the Mid-Atlantic. One very, very prominent veterinarian, world-renowned, said to me, you know, Alan, if you can't coordinate and get it right in the Mid-Atlantic, you're going to have a SH-blank-T show. It's a mess. And so we learned years ago, we have to cooperate, we have to do this cooperatively, and when we make changes, we have to do it collectively as a region. And I think that we're evidence-based. I think we have evidence to show what we're doing, and we're pulling from the science. You know, we've learned so much more since 2012 today than we knew back in 2012 when we made our recommendations. And it's an evolving situation.
The parallels going back to the formation of the New York Task Force, I mean, there you talk about the parallels, I think about the government pressures, and Albany absolutely put pressure on, and yet it, and I don't know if that's a question of California's uniqueness in terms of the, you know, the social makeup in general in California, and how Sacramento relates to the populace, and you know what is perceived as public opinion, but in New York, there was alarm. But there wasn't the rancor and the almost violent reaction to things that people didn't understand, that people didn't want to hear an explanation for. And, you know, there's so many pieces of evidence, you know, now several months removed, even with the Mongolian groom situation, that tells a completely different story than what people's perception is. And that includes the California's overall fatality rate is down for the year.
Let me give you a different statistic that, you know, I'm going to get ripped, I know, for putting out this statistic, but Tim Parkin, who is somebody we work with the task force, an internationally recognized expert in the study of risk management in horses and breakdowns, issued a paper several years ago, and it covered a period from 2009 to 2013, which includes the New York 21 fatalities at Aqueduct. And they, in his study, they reported that there were almost 1.9 million starts in that period in North American and Canadian racing, and the safety rate, the horses, the non-fatality, the safety rate was 98.8%. We are, all this work that we're doing is to try to fix that 1.2% that are fatalities. Any other business would tout a safety record like that. You know, they go, wow, we've got a 98.8% safety record. In racing, that doesn't work. That 1.2% number is a killer for us. And that's what we're all working on to get down. And I one other thing I'll just tell you, I lived the New York situation in 2011, 2012. It was intense. You had a governor who wanted to shut down racing. It was on all the newscasts in New York. It just – It feels more intense now, and with social media, which wasn't what it was 8 years, it's just more intense now. And you have a federal bill, by the way, and everybody has latched onto that as the answer to racing's ills is just pass the federal bill and everything's going to be fine. And the fact of the matter is that federal bill wouldn't do anything to reduce the fatality situation that we have.
You know, one thing, and I probably won't talk to Chuck again until Thursday, but I'm going to start this industry answers segment with Chuck Simon as you know, representing the horsemen in Florida. And Chuck brought out a something that I'm shocked has not made the rounds more, you know, more pronounced basis. Without a supposed, you know, five vet panel to examine horses and a five vet panel to look at entries and check epidemiology, Gulfstream West ran a meet with much cheaper horses than were running on the West Coast. Zero fatalities without pronounced protocols or anything else. On a racetrack, on a turf course that looks like a plowed field, and on a main track that isn't being maintained the way it was, as you know, years ago, when it was one of the best, safest, and best surfaces for horses in the game, they didn't have a single incident. What does that tell you about the randomness of these factors? And how do you present this? I'm not one for presenting safety records as you. Del Mar learned this lesson the hard way. Oh, we had a fabulous summer. No fan, and then three in 72 hours. You can't merchandise this.
No, you can't, and it's complicated. Well, one of the things we've learned is that weather and climate clearly is affecting our business in a way that historically we have not seen. Whether it was 2011, 2012, whether it's in the Mid-Atlantic this summer, because we had some spikes. They had a spike at Belmont. They had a little spike at Parks. We had a drought in the Mid-Atlantic this summer. We're learning that when horses run for a long period of time on one surface and then change to another, going from Saratoga to Belmont, or going from Laurel to Pimlico or whatever, that you see early in the meets, you can see a spike in fatalities, and it's got something to do with that transition. To me, you have to be transparent about it, and you have to be objective about it. We can do all these reforms, and I'll come in today and I'll show the progress that we've made in the Mid-Atlantic, but there are no guarantees that there isn't going to be another cluster.
Nope.
They happen. They're rare, but they could happen. What we need to do is implement the best risk management strategies that we can find, because they work. And hope that we can get that 1.2% number that I talk about, the fatalities, get that lower. Our goal is zero. I doubt we'll ever get to zero. But I would be willing to bet that if Tim Parkin came in and studied the North American population from 2013, his previous study, to now, that number's lower. I know we've done better. And New York had the lowest fatality rate in decades last year. In Maryland, we're down about 25, a little bit more than 25% with 3 weeks to go. You keep your fingers crossed. There may be other states that had zero fatalities in 2018 that may have had two or three in 2019. So their number will go up. But overall, we've been able to bring it down. It's just that we're in a situation now where every fatality is a catastrophe, and it's being reported as such.
I'll ask you the same question we asked Dr. Durenberger, or you know, floated a similar, you know, conceptual discussion, which is presenting a message, a uniform message, from all the industry organs. And I referenced you and THA and Eric Hamelbeck and HPPA, Gagliano and Jockey Club. I should include Alex Waldrop and NTRA. You could literally go through, you know, all the industry arms and organs, and everybody issues, you know, supportive and you know, reactions to circumstances. But is there a way for us to present a more consistent and more unified message that confronts, in a lot of cases, misinformation, clickbait nonsense, and sensationalized stupidity, that, you know, pita and the pizza maker and the other, you know, people that are strictly out for their own fundraising interests, how do we counteract in an environment and in a society right now that is just rampant with misinformation as a tactic? How do we stop that?
Well, it's hard to do because we're a divided industry. And when you have a segment of the industry that believes that the answer is the federal legislation that's been introduced and that's going to solve our problems, and you hear that from the animal rights groups, and you hear that from every day it's rolled out by somebody who says that we have to revolutionize the sport, so pass the Horse Racing Integrity Act. I can tell you what we need to do collectively as an industry, and I think that everybody, all the groups you've mentioned, support the work that we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic and that others are doing on safety reforms. It, you know, if you could get everybody behind that message and not that the federal bill is the answer, you could do that. But you can't message when you have a divided organization, a divided industry. And so that's been the challenge, and that's going to continue to be the challenge until we can coalesce. The good news is there is an effort among industry leaders to get to where you're talking.
I was just going to ask you that. I think we're slowly climbing that mountain.
It's happening.
It is happening. And you know, it's a shame that it has to happen under duress rather than just normal business practices. But I think it is. We have the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition
coming
on board. And the fact that they have nothing concrete right now, but the fact that all the major groups in racing seem to be in this, which we've never really had before. We always had a couple on the outside looking in. I don't know what the bottom line or what they're trying to try and get done, but it seems like it just gives an appearance that we are starting to work together a little bit.
Well, there is a serious effort underway, and it's complicated. And I'm optimistic it will get done because I think we need to find a way to mandate safety standards throughout the industry with a hammer. If you don't comply, then there are consequences for not complying. And I would even be willing to see that happen through a federal mandate, not federal legislation, but a federal requirement that if you don't do it and you don't comply, then you don't get, you know, you're going to get stripped of certain things that you do. There'll be an economic penalty for not complying. And it's a shame you have to have a hammer, but that's what happens when you got a small group that doesn't want to go along. But the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition, from what I can see, is very much the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan. And they've also pulled in some safety reforms that they've seen elsewhere, and they're trying to coalesce it behind that group of tracks that historically hasn't participated in these efforts. So it's a good thing, because I think eventually everything will coalesce into one program that we all can get behind, and then it's easier to message.
And in this instance, copying is a good thing. Somebody has to start somewhere.
Something's working.
And there's nothing wrong with jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak, and say, hey, you know what? This is a great place to start. I'm sure what is in that what you've put together in the Mid-Atlantic now will be different in another year or two or three.
I sure hope so.
But we have to start somewhere. And if everybody can just jump in on the bottom level and say, this is a great place to start, we'll try a few things. Some will work, some won't. But we're all doing the same thing, and that's the division in this game, is we all do something different.
You hinted at a couple of things that I think we've got we have the opportunity with you to flesh out. Explain for those that on message boards and under articles and on Twitter think that this federal bill is something that it absolutely is not. Explain what it is, what it addresses, why it could or couldn't work, and who's going to pay for it, because that has been hidden and obscured in this incantation.
Well, the Horse Racing Integrity Act is solely medication related. So if you want to talk about the issues that we face from a safety, welfare, and best interest of the horse, medication is just one piece of a much larger puzzle, which is why it doesn't solve the breakdown problem. What the Horse Racing Integrity Act does is it strips the state racing commissions, the state regulatory bodies, of their ability to regulate in the arena of medication. And it creates an authority to be comprised primarily of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, representatives, and then a group of hand-picked individuals from the horse racing industry who will make the rules for medication using NUMP and using some of the other paradigms that we have in the industry, making the rules and enforcing the rules through enforcement mechanisms. So essentially, it's transferring control of the regulatory aspects of a part of our industry from the states. We're a state-sanctioned, state-regulated sport and industry, to a federally appointed and federally authorized authority or commission that will regulate. So you'll, in my view, whether you like the bill or not, it will create some regulatory havoc, because you're going to have the state commissions regulating everything else, and in the area of medication, you're going to have this federally appointed group.
How in this version of it, because there's been...
It's the same version. It hasn't changed with one...
With two notable exceptions.
Well, the most notable exception is in the previous iterations of the bill, horse owners in the industry were paying for, and they would be taxed by, the racing commissions would be taxed by this authority, who would then collect it from the industry locally to pay for. It's an unfunded mandate. There isn't even a budget. We don't even know how much they could decide how much money they want to collect to run this authority, and then they go back and tax the individuals in the industry to pay for it. The change this year is it also taxes the bettors. So it would be the bettors and the owners who would be paying for the cost of doing this. And that's, look, I've got problems from an enforcement standpoint, because it takes the horsemen out of a state-regulated a jurisdictional and enforcement program, and gives it to the federal government through arbitration and appeals through federal courts. You know, if they think that the industry is too slow to discipline offending trainers, and that group gets smaller and smaller every year, put it over into the federal system and watch how long it takes to get something done. like anything else. I mean, there are a lot of people who like the bill. There are a lot of people who don't like the bill. And I just don't think it is. What irks me is the people suggest that that bill is going to solve a much bigger problem we have in this industry, and that bill doesn't touch it.
The other topic that is seemingly once again reaching a flashpoint is this Lasix discussion, and KHRC yesterday managed to bring the subcommittee in line. They obviously browbeat them into complying with whatever initiatives seem to be coming from as myopic a group of breeders as I've ever seen. It is stunning to me that there's a handful of breeders being allowed to push their agenda when it comes to Lasix, thinking that I don't know how they think all the stallions at all the farms in Kentucky are going to continue to stand when the industry will simply winnow down further and further. It makes no sense to me. But talk about what went on yesterday and what apparently is some momentum among the anti-Lasix crowd.
Well, look, Steve, there's no question that what's happening with the Lasix issue is a political. It's not a scientific issue. It's a political issue in the environment we're in right now. Political issues and political solutions tend to have a much stronger hand. So we all know that Lasix is the third rail of American racing. It's our abortion. It's our gun control. It's actually paralyzed our sport in trying to move forward with reform. Mm-hmm. I happen to be on the side of the argument that is in favor of the current regulatory practice. I have friends and colleagues who are on the other side of the issue, and it's been very difficult to try to find a way through this. The coalition of tracks, including Churchill, Keeneland, NYRA, the Strina Group, as part of reforms that they announced a number of months ago, move for a partial elimination of Lasix, to eliminate it in two-year-olds beginning this year and then in stakes races beginning in 2021. the way the Kentucky framework works, they have an equine drug council that makes medication recommendations to the racing commission that usually follows them, and then it goes to a legislative committee and has to be approved by their legislature. The Equine Drug Council initially voted to support the current regime and not to go with the partial elimination. They called themselves back together 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, revoted, determined to go with the partial elimination, recommended it to the Racing Commission, which rubber stamped it yesterday. It will go, I assume, to a legislative committee, but my instincts tell me, and I'm not involved in Kentucky racing at all, my instincts tell me that's a done deal in Kentucky. And I expect that New York, I think that New York needs the Gaming Commission to change its current regulations to prohibit the use of Lasix in two-year-olds, but they can do it in on a race-by-race basis, so they'll do it in the stakes races. And I think New York will come on board. So you'll have California, Kentucky, New York, and I think their hope is that that will force the rest of the industry to go along. Mid-Atlantic has taken a position that it supports the current practice, and any change that will occur in the Mid-Atlantic will be a regional change and not a state-by-state change. Now, New York will break off from that, but the rest of the Mid-Atlantic will have to decide what direction it wants to go.
Out of curiosity, let's say everybody comes on board and slow but sure, or you know, fast, like we did with steroids, everybody moves in that same inexorable direction. What happens when there's no change and there's, you know, you're putting off the horse players? There continues to be, you know, we heard that steroids was the boogeyman, and there'd be so much more players come back to the game if we eliminated steroids. That didn't happen. What happens when nothing ostensibly changes with the after the elimination of Lasix?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by what happens if nothing changes.
What happens when we still, you know, even as we work forward and continue to try to be safer and et cetera, you're still going to have horses break down. Yeah. That's not going to change. Lasix elimination is certainly not going to bring back the bettors. In fact, if you read Jerry Brown's piece, letter in the TDN, it's actually the other way. The horse players will be less sure about the question of how horses coming off Lasix are going to react. It only adds to uncertainty.
My question in this situation. Remember, 5-6 years ago, the Breeders' Cup decided to run Lasix-free two-year-old races. And that was fine. I got that.
Yeah, that's right.
We talked about that. I said, okay, yeah, go ahead and go for it. My assumption was they were going to test them. They did it to test these horses and see what the reaction was. Well, they didn't do any testing. And so I don't know what they decided on. So in this situation, are there protocols put in place where they're going to be some kind of testing to see what the results are as far as, you know, the bleeding situation goes? Or it's just going to be a blanket, no Lasix, we don't want to know what happens or what the effect is going to be on the horse?
So there were two recent studies that were done to determine whether or not you could back out the administration of Lasix 24 hours and what effect it would have. The initial results from both of those studies were that it would not result in a positive change, and that you could not back out Lasix to 24 hours. It was most effective at least, but somewhere between 4 and 9 hours, whatever the number is. But clearly on race day, it was most effective. Larry Bramlage, widely respected veterinarian in this country, dug into the data, and he thought he saw something, that if there were horses in that study who were treated at 24 hours, that if you could administer Lasix at 24 hours, withdraw water, manage their water and food, it might reduce the incidence of bleeding. And he thought that was a promising development. And there are people now seriously looking at that. But that was a study of 6 horses, 8 horses. You can't draw conclusions from that.
I thought the Jockey Club did something along those lines as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody, the Jockey Club's looking at it. We had Heather Knitch at the University of California looking at it. We had another research paper that was done, I think, in Washington State. What we have not come up with, I don't think, is the money and the research to try to find an alternative to Lasix. And the AAEP, the THA, our historical position has been that the current practice is in the best interest of the safety and welfare of the horse, and there should not be any change until there's a better alternative. Now, I think the AAP is going to change that position because they're under tremendous political pressure, and I think they're taking another look at it. But so there will be studies done to look at the effect of 24 hours, and if there's some way we can do that. And they're going to have to look at other alternatives because, look, somebody's going to be right and somebody's going to be wrong in this debate when they start implementing these changes. I don't know whether you're going to see horses that are going to come off the track, that owners are going to just abandon them because they're bleeders and they can't treat them, which is going to tax our aftercare facilities. Maybe the horsemen will adjust, and we've been crying, you know, fire for too long. Who knows? But that's, we're about to find out. Will we go back to the days when they were, horsemen were using all kinds of different concoctions and therapies and things? I think we may go back to that. I know what these horsemen are probably going to be inclined to do to manage this problem. But somebody's going to be right and somebody's going to be wrong, and we're going to find out.
What happened to the study that the Stronach Group commissioned that apparently didn't have the results that they were looking for and has just disappeared?
I think it just disappeared. I'm not familiar with it. Look, there have been efforts at various times, but this has become a political issue. It was introduced back in 2011 as the not as a scientific advancement, but as a political issue because of the inability of the breeding community to sell in the international markets and the pressure coming from international markets on North American racing. You hear this drumbeat about drugs in North American racing. You know, I'm looking at the statistics for the positive tests in the Mid-Atlantic as I do every year, and the numbers keep coming down. The multiple penalty system has eliminated multiple offenders. We're not seeing serious doping issues any longer. Give me one from this year. You can't think of one. Since the Dimorphin issue, I'm not sure there's been one.
You mentioned that. I've brought up Dr. Arthur's name here more times than I've in the last week than I have in the last year.
But you did
year.
Working in California
yeah,
for
no,
years.
No, we worked together a lot. But, I mean, he used to come to me with these stats. He goes, I don't even know why we test anymore. We've caught three people in the last, 10,000 tests. And it's working. I mean, we're doing the right thing.
But here's the problem. And this is a problem that's age old, and we've discussed this a million times. You got people who, you see Steve Aspison and Clark Brewster fighting these two ace positives. People writing, oh, Aspison, what are you talking about? They don't know what ace is. They don't know that there's residual from putting a horse on a van or having the dentist pull a tooth or have, I mean, it's the, there's a
could
craziest,
be
anything.
Could be a colicky horse.
You're giving a horse an aspirin and you got the public, the public perception, the whole gypsum weed situation, people now, again, sensationalized misinformation meant to smear the industry, in a lot of cases coming from within, and the public has no idea, no matter how many times we try to explain it and flesh it out. And I don't know, Alan, if freezing samples what's happened to that concept about being able to go back and back test. I did see one thing encouraging the other day about funding, and I'm going to forget what state was it that talked about spending more for research it might have been California. It might have been part of this California thing.
I mean, it could be. Look, we're looking at that all the time. We freeze samples. You can go back and look at samples. You're not finding anything.
No.
I think
with
that
the advancements in understanding, because there's people who just are so convinced that there's guys, they've got undetectables. It's all undetected.
Well, that's all. That gets down to out-of-competition testing. And look, when it comes to drug testing, and you're always being asked to prove a negative, negative, and it's impossible to do. We have enhanced our out-of-competition testing. They do it in New York. They do it in California. They're not finding anything. But nonetheless, you have to do it because it's a deterrent. I think the thing that we're looking at now is, the regime in horse racing is you always tested the winner. You always tested the horse that finished second. And if the stewards wanted to, they could pick somebody randomly.
Right.
You had a badly beaten favorite, so you order a special on the horse. And they never produce anything. The conversation now is maybe we need to get away from that. Maybe we need to devote less money to the way we're doing current post-race testing and put more money into out-of-competition testing. One of the reasons I like that idea is because of this notion that there's all this stuff going on in training and there's all this stuff on the backstretch. The only way you're going to prove that it's not the case is to do more out-of-competition testing. But you only have so many resources. So what do? Do you protect the better or do you protect the rest of the industry? Do you put it into out-of-competition testing or do you put it into post-race testing? And that's what you have to figure out.
A couple of different areas. What about the opportunity to monitor, stall monitoring in terms of, video? We got cheap video camera systems that can be put virtually in every stall. Of course, the training centers are a whole different story and potentially different issue. And what about the commissary concept? One of the few things that when I hear people talk about Hong Kong, one of the few things that does seem to have some merit, and I know Frank Stronach himself wanted to do this, which is to have a commissary, to have a pharmacy on track, and the only products allowed on the racetrack have to be procured through that commissary system. That, I would think, would go a long way. Would it not? Why can't that be done?
In theory, it's great. In practice, it's very difficult to
Why?
Do. First of all, you got to get all the tracks to buy in to want to do it because they're the ones who are going to be doing it. Not the racing commissions, but the racetracks that are going to go into the pharmacy business. I'm not suggesting that you couldn't do it. I just don't know how practical it is, what the cost would be. And from their standpoint, since the tracks are always looking at liability, what the liability issues are. Nonetheless, Frank proposed it.
Right.
He had the wherewithal to do it. How many years ago was that proposed?
Yeah.
And how far along is the proposal? That's just one track operator with money who could have done it and hasn't done it. So now you expect Naira to do it. You expect Churchill to do it. You expect Delaware Park to do it. You expect Parks to do it. You expect Monmouth to do it. It's a tall order.
Once again, we talk about the follow-through. We talk about all these great ideas.
It's easy to do it in Hong Kong, but Hong Kong,
right.
What do they have, 900 horses? I mean, they got a smaller horse population than
and they control
Parks.
They control everything.
They own the horses.
Yeah, it's very easy to do.
You mentioned...
you got a bleeder, send him out, bring another one in.
You mentioned cameras. Well, we put cameras in at Santa Anita 4 years ago, and not one person said, as long as, it's the old, if he's getting looked at, that's fine. As long as we're all being looked at the same time, it's been great. And, everyone's known. I mean, they're not just in the barns. They're not into every stall, but they're angled so you can see who goes in and out of every stall and every barn, and they're all over the parking lot, and you can see people coming and going. And you know what? Everybody knows they're on camera back there, and it's really helped.
I think it's absolutely essential. The Stronach Group has done it at Laurel. But with the new rebuild in Maryland coming, it'll be state of the art. So it's going to be easy to monitor the backstretch at Laurel when that new backstretch is done in 2 years.
And I think that should be another thing that's mandatory.
It will set the standard.
Yeah.
Bar none.
And it's not, the mall cop sitting there looking at 48 cameras. What's going on here? Everything's recorded. It's on movement. It's, he's sitting there. One guy's looking at this wall going, oh, wait a minute. There's a guy over there eating a Snickers. So everything's recorded, and it has gone back. And if there's a situation.
Poppy seed bagel.
We're able to go back and look
at
the
our biggest problem in the Mid-Atlantic is that not everybody's stable at the racetrack.
Well, I was going to follow up with training center. I mean, whether it's the hyperbaric and some of the other
shockwave.
Exactly.
I mean, you name it. It's the biggest challenge is these racing commissions don't have
buzzword.
The authority to go off property. I mean, we do it with out of competition testing. It's a condition of licensing. New Jersey licenses training facilities, but Fair Hill is not under anybody's jurisdiction, and they feed horses to Maryland, to Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania.
And they're private,
they're private, and there are other private facilities around.
Payson Park.
Yeah, and so that's a real challenge, too. And the horsemen at the stable at the racetrack say, well, what about those guys? What are you doing for the people? I can abide by all these rules, but what about the people shipping in?
And it's legitimate, and that's the problem. There's holes. There's little holes in everything.
Yeah. So, whatever.
We're trying to plug.
Exactly.
The finger in the dike.
Exactly.
The good news, Steve, is the Mat Series is coming back.
That's what we like we just, to hear after another
we
big
got
year.
The regional agreement. We're going to announce the schedule pretty soon.
We want
it's going to grow this year.
We want Sal Sinatra's 60-second pick six back. That was the greatest.
I'm sorry if I changed the subject on you.
That's
here,
all right. We're going to wrap up.
That's a good
It's a good move. We're bringing Charlestown back, and we're bringing Colonial back, so the series is going to
expand.
Wow, and we're going to do some cool things. I mean, it really has taken off.
But when I mentioned it earlier before you got here, Alan, I used it as an example of there is
cooperation.
I mean, to get 6-7 tracks to cooperate and actually move races on the schedule to say, hey, you know what, this is good for the whole. It should be a footstep up to the door of getting along on other things.
When I started coordinating the meetings in the region 25 years ago, it was just regulators essentially talking about Medicaid. We were trying to work on licensing medication. There may be 15 people we would get together once a year. When we started doing the safety and welfare after the New York report, we ended up with 130 people in the room. We have, and if you look at the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan, we have every stakeholder involved in horse racing, who are participating and who have committed. It's pretty mind-boggling to think that among 7 states that everybody has committed and is pulling in one direction to make this better.
What's the potential and how much conversation is there on that topic with date coordination and particularly stakes coordination? You and I have had this discussion, Hammer, for years about not trying to draw upon the same divisions within days and weeks of each other, fillies and mares long on the dirt.
What could
be done there?
That was the specific conversation. It's what drives Match. I mean, we had some incidents last year where, notwithstanding the commitment that one track wouldn't run races on top of another in the Match series, it happened. And that was a fundamental conversation this year, and we believe that we've got a process in place to protect the Match series races. When you look at the schedules and you've got all the racing directors in the room and they have their big days or they have their stake here, trying to coordinate is an immensely difficult task. People have no appreciation for how difficult it is, but it's been our starting point. We now have, through the Mid-Atlantic plan and Match, all the racing directors now meeting. So if we can get consensus on safety, welfare, we get consensus on Match, we can move into other areas. I mean, it's a very competitive environment. For the first time, I'm seeing that instead of looking out for your own individual track, they're starting to look out for the best interests of the region. So, I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to transition from what we're doing into a much greater discussion. I think it has to happen. Just given the horse population, I think it's essential that we do it.
Exactly. It makes for better racing for everybody, bigger fields, and it's just a win-win for everybody, no doubt. And, of course, we close every conversation with the same update.
So,
New Pimlico.
Then we expect legislation to be introduced at the beginning of the legislative session, if it's not pre-introduced by leadership. Session opens on January the 8th. We, assuming there are no hiccups, believe that the bill will be moved early and quickly. And if so, we are not seeing any roadblocks. The governor signs the bill. We will start the process as soon as the governor signs the bill. The timeline is aggressive, but we believe that we could begin the movement of the horse population out of Laurel by right after Maryland Million, so around November 30th next year, the latest, move the horse population to Pimlico, perhaps Timonium, whatever, and we will begin the full scrape of Laurel at this time next year. We'll stay at Pimlico elsewhere until Laurel backstretch new surfaces are finished. Laurel Clubhouse will be under construction, and then everything will move back to Laurel, and we will start the scrape of Pimlico. And if the timeline holds, we're looking at both facilities being done, hopefully, by Preakness 2024. The Preakness, during all this construction, will not ever move from Pimlico, so you may come 1 year, Steve, broadcasting, and a tent or something. I don't think it'll be a permanent structure, but it'll be pretty cool for everybody to be able to see the once-in-a-lifetime transformation of a racing industry, because I don't know that it's going to happen anywhere else. So it's going to be pretty cool to watch and be a part of, and Maryland racing is going to look very different in the next few years.
Now, and you, we can all assume that it'll basically sit as a, you know, as a shining jewel and as a an example for the rest of the industry.
Well, we certainly hope so. And with all the negative things that are happening, this is certainly something that should give everybody a big lift.
Every visit of Alan Foreman elevates. Alan Foreman lifts all boats.
You're very kind. I wish a lot of other people felt that way.
Let's take a break. A fabulous visit. Dickie Powell is circulating like CompSat, and we'll get Dick. We've got to recap what went on at Sha-Tin on Sunday morning. What at that point? The Japanese, they're probably still partying. Japanese dominant at the HKIR. Alan Foreman dominant industry wide. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $125 are on them. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code BYK. That's B-Y-K. And you'll get $125 when you wager $500 within your first 30 days. See what I mean? House money just for playing the races you were going to bet anyway. Check out ExpressBet.com for more information. And don't forget to sign up using promo code BYK. B-Y-K to get that $125 bonus. You're going to love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee.
Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states. Open account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void, or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
The North American fall crop continues to decline, but not here in Pennsylvania. In 2019, our number of mares bred increased for the third year in a row, this time by 12.5%. Why? Our stallion roster continues to grow. We have the best incentives and bonuses. Plus, there's the stability of our racehorse development fund. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
You talk about Santa Claus. You want to know what it's all about. Santa Claus got drunk last night. Everybody tried to throw him out. But I want to tell you, folks, how it all began. Santa stopped at a neighbor's house and started drinking good gin. Now, while I was with him, I named a few. I'd love to name some of them whiskeys that Santa was drinking to you. It was way back in the ancient age, down in Mid Spring Valley, where the crab tree grows. An old granddaddy bought a rocking chair for Mr. Boston. One day we're rocking in the mellow breeze. The rocking chair broke and threw him bottom up. He jumped up thinking about his old drum. He saddled his white horse, said he's going over to Johnny Walker.
Ah, how great is this?
Past the cabin still.
Clad Leslie. And the Cadillac Baby Special. Santa come home drunk. Can't beat it. You know, there's a lot more songs when you listen to this. There's a lot more songs that do what this does. like George Thorogood, name songs that incorporate the names of liquor brands and beers, right? I mean, there's this one, there's the George Thorogood, and there's also a few others. It must have been a genre at some point.
One bourbon, one scotch, and one beer?
Yeah.
I drink alone?
I drink alone is the one.
When I prefer to be by myself.
Exactly. I drink alone is the one. But there's others like this. I love that, though. Santa came home drunk.